This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. Now, its official designation is 2019-nCoV. It emerged just after Christmas in China. It's a virus and it's spreading. But what do we really know about this new coronavirus and how should the world respond? The first horseman of the apocalypse is pestilence. So when news broke of a new coronavirus outbreak in China, the first question was always going to be, could this be the big one? So far, more than 600 people have been confirmed as having been infected, and the death toll is nearly 20. As we recorded this programme, the World Health Organization was pondering whether to declare an international health emergency. So what do you and I need to know about this new coronavirus? What is it? How dangerous is it? And what should we do about it? Step inside the carefully disinfected briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I need to know more about where this virus came from. This is Howard Zhang, editor of the BBC's China service.
The first confirmed case was actually after the New Year. So in early January, people around China and later on around the world start to hear there's this new strain of virus called new coronavirus. But of course, the early detection of the virus could be as early as late December. It started right bang in the center of China in a city called Wuhan. Wuhan, in terms of size, 11 million people. In world terms, it's a megacity, 11 million, but in Chinese terms, it's called a tier 2 city. And it sits right in the middle of the railway, as well as Yangtze River transportation network. So it's one of those travel hubs. So in that sense, it's geographically located perfectly for an outbreak. It started in a suburban wet market. In many parts of Asia, people want their produce and their food, especially animal products, fresh. So we're talking about live poultry and live animals of many sorts. When you buy your product, the farmer will kill the animal on site, and they will gut the animal on site, prepare it, and then hand it over to you, as well as in giant water tanks, seafood. So that's the environment you can imagine. the virus jumped from animal products onto human, then eventually spread from there. This new strain of virus is capable of being transmitted between humans. The symptoms is very much like common flu and pneumonia. So start from fever, coughing, sweating, and of course spells of dizziness. But the most acute symptoms are difficulty in breathing. So far, one of the most widely read articles was a health professional who got infected and struggled through. He said just all of a sudden, he lost all control. And then 22 hours later, there were signs of recovery. He later wrote, only because of my immune system fought it off. Otherwise, fate would have taken me. Within China, it's spread quite wide already. So far, out of the 30-some provinces we got, now it's 20 provinces got confirmed cases. The virus has definitely spread outside China. The neighboring countries such as South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong all got confirmed cases. Thailand, recently even Seattle in the US had a confirmed case. There were some rumors about confirmed cases in UK, but that's not checked out yet. Now the latest is to call for people of Wuhan not to move, to stay where you are, to try to avoid unnecessary trips, and for people in Wuhan not to leave the city, and for people not to go into the city from outside. So we're talking about a citywide quarantine, and also they're now setting up emergency centers at all key hospitals with volunteer medical staff wearing complete overall kind of protection gear to take in anybody who's come in for fever, cough, will be referred right away to intensive care. So there's a front line being set up. Chinese New Year is coming up. It's actually tomorrow night. It's like Christmas here. And every year, on average, over 1.2 billion people will move from place to place. So people flying from overseas, moving from city to city. So the railways, the airports, they will handle over 1.7 billion people's movement. The New Year's necessity for travel is definitely going to put strains on the health defenses of Wuhan City, because to persuade tens of millions of people, please stay put and don't go where you need to go, it is going to be difficult.
Howard Zhang. That's the where. Now the what and the how. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Natalie McDermott, a specialist in infectious diseases from Imperial College London. Natalie McDermott, let's talk about this new coronavirus. If I was to look into a microscope, what would I see?
Essentially, it's called a coronavirus because it resembles, if you look at it in 2D, a bit like a crown. So it's essentially a ball with lots of little spiky projections coming off it.
What is a virus and how does a new one come about?
There are many different families of viruses in the world, and within each family of viruses, there's different species of viruses, and each species can be slightly different. So essentially, even though if you look at it under a microscope, it might look generally the same, if you look at the genetic makeup of the virus, there'll be some slight differences. And those differences can predict a little bit about how severe the infection might be, how good the virus is at spreading, how infectious it is.
It may seem a bit of a silly question, but why would a virus want to infect a human anyway?
So it needs to get into a human cell to borrow some of the proteins in that cell to copy its genetic makeup and make more of its own particles.
Now, if this thing enters an animal or a human, why does it make you ill?
Because your body recognises it, says, this shouldn't be here, and tries to kill it. And by doing that, you release chemicals to kill it off. And it's those chemicals, we call them cytokines and chemokines, that actually give you the first symptoms. So like the fever, the muscle aches and pains and things like that. That's all a result of your immune system trying to kill the virus.
The last big one of these I remember was the thing called SARS. Remind me what SARS stood for?
So SARS is severe acute respiratory syndrome. That was also a coronavirus. This current coronavirus, we think, has about 70% the same genetic makeup as SARS. But obviously that 30% difference could be key in how it behaves. leaves.
And have there been any other recent coronavirus outbreaks?
So SARS was in 2002, 2003, and then MERS, which is Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, that's found in camels. That doesn't seem to be as severe as SARS.
And where does the current one stand, as far as we can tell, in relation to MERS?
This virus behaves almost a little bit in between MERS and SARS. SARS was possibly more infectious, although we're still learning about this new virus. But this one does seem to spread a little bit more readily between people.
So it could be the person next to you on the train?
Yes. I mean, there's lots of factors that come into play in terms of how infectious a person can be. We have people that we sometimes call super spreaders. So for whatever...
Super spreaders?
Yes. So for whatever reason, they are people who shed a lot of virus. But that means that even just a small amount of droplet fluid from them could cause infection. But there are other people who don't produce that much. So them sneezing may not infect as many people. That's why it's always difficult to gauge sort of how many new cases you get from one case of an infection.
What specifically about being proximity to a wet market and all those different kinds of animals makes it a situation in which a new virus, which can go to human beings, can be created?
It's literally the exposure to the potential host or reservoir of the virus. So for whatever reason, certain animals can carry viruses. Some of them just carry them and aren't infected by them, so they're not unwell with them, but they happen to carry it and they shed it in their urine. So we see that with bats. They aren't infected with Ebola, but they carry it. And so in their urine, they can express Ebola. And then if you were a human or a chimpanzee or something like that, you come into contact with that, you can be infected with Ebola. In a market situation, you often have possibly not ideal hygiene conditions. You have a high population density of people moving around, and you have an animal which potentially can transmit that virus. And it's really just that introduction of contact to the host that permits it. There also used to be a cultural practice in China of sneezing or spitting on the ground, which obviously there's a risk there, especially if you do a really good cough and clear of your throat and then spit it on the ground, that that could transmit. But the public health authorities in China have really been trying to address that in recent years and cutting down on it significantly in public places.
So who's actually dying from this new virus?
The people that do seem to be succumbing to the virus really are people who are in the elderly age bracket and who maybe have significant medical problems already. So they might have heart disease, or they may have had a stroke, or they might have diabetes. So these things are predisposing people to having more severe disease, whereas SARS was quite damaging to people who didn't necessarily have significant medical problems.
So at the moment, it doesn't look so bad, either in terms of its spread or in terms of its seriousness?
I think so. But as I said, we're at the very early stages and it's really watching how it evolves over time.
Do you think that so far the authorities in China have handled this better than they did the SARS outbreak?
Yes, absolutely. They've been very open this time. With SARS, there was a lot of rumours, but no actual clear data early on, at least, until it had spread quite significantly. They have behaved in a completely different manner this time. They have been very open with what's going on, releasing statements. And now there's daily statements about the number of cases, number of provinces affected.
As a doctor, if a worried person comes up to you and says, I'm worried about this new virus, I'm nothing like so worried about flu as I used to be. Would you say that they got their priorities right or wrong?
I would say that they've probably got their priorities wrong. Flu does actually kill quite a large number of people every year. They estimate about 80,000 people each year die of influenza throughout the world. The problem is, though, that we don't generally screen the background population for influenza. So if you're trying to come up with a mortality rate, it's very difficult to say, well, this number of people died, but actually we don't know how many cases there were, because there may have been a large number of cases who really just had a bit of a cough and a cold and body aches, but never went to a hospital or a doctor, were never tested. So it's very difficult to come up with an exact mortality rate for influenza. And it's the same with this coronavirus. So I would say, no, you need to be concerned about influenza as well, especially if you're in an older age group or the very young or someone with medical problems. You should every year you should access that influenza vaccine that you can, because that will significantly protect you.
Thanks, Natalie. Now, I want to know more about the history of pandemics, how they work, and where outbreaks like this new coronavirus fit into that pattern, and then what to do about it. Joining me and Natalie in the briefing room now are Professor John Oxford, a virologist from Queen Mary's College London, and Dr. Josie Golding from the Epidemic Preparedness and Response Programme at the Wellcome Trust. John Oxford, the spectre haunting us must always be that great flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919. Now, I suppose the first question I want to ask you, and actually the others as well, is could that ever happen again?
Well, I sometimes think of that at night, just about before I'm going to sleep. When I wake up in the morning, I always feel the answer is no. We've got vaccines against flu, we've got antiviral drugs, and new ones have only just been discovered. So I don't think we could ever envisage the 1918 scenario coming again. I really don't.
Do you agree with that, Josie?
I do believe there's a lot of unknown on basic immunology, like how our body works with the virus and whether that would make any difference if a new virus came along. But there have been projections. I know Bill Gates from the Gates Foundation put out a model last year that said within 6 months, 30 million people could be dead. I mean, that's quite a severe figure. I don't think that's going to happen.
What, from an unknown
pandemic influenza virus? I don't feel that could happen, but I do think we need to still keep focusing on having vaccines that are better, more broadly protective against many different types of influenza viruses.
Natalie, do we have a unanimity of relative optimism?
I think so, but I think that the world is very different now to what it was in 1918, and the advent of international travel on the scale that we have now, if we don't continue to follow the principles that we already have in place, such as prompt communication with one another, there is the potential for widespread transmission of a potential virus to lots of different locations. And we do have antiviral drugs, but if it's something that we've never seen before, it will take some time to develop ones that are specific to that particular virus. So yes, I'm optimistic because I think the world is in a much better place in terms of preparedness. But I also think we have a much more interconnected world than we did in 1918.
Now, we've had previous pandemics, bird flu in the late 90s and SARS in 2002. In the case of SARS, how many people were infected and how many people died? Josie?
I think it was around 8,000 people infected that we know of.
Yeah.
And around 800 people died.
I would say one other thing about the SARS outbreak in 2002, that was a shocker, because it came from a family of viruses that were an innocent family.
Family of viruses.
Well, I knew them as a student. We used to give them to people and volunteers. Little respiratory things, didn't do anything at all. You know, give you a common cold. And suddenly, 2002-3, one, a coronavirus of that family suddenly emerged and started killing people. And then since then, we've had the MERS emerging from a bat into a camel into humans. Now we've got this one.
That does kind of beg the question, if we can have viruses that we thought were pretty much benign, it does beg the question about where the next virus might come from.
Well, yes, and I think that that's why we have these sort of pandemic preparedness plans, because it's not entirely clear. We can come up with the most likely scenarios of where it might come from, or which viruses we know mutate quicker than others, which ones might be more likely to jump the species barrier. But yes, that's why we have preparedness for essentially disease X, which is an unknown disease, likely to be a virus. And we have to have plans in place that cater towards the different manifestations of that virus in terms of how it transmits. For instance, Ebola transmits through direct contact. If someone were to sneeze in your face, potentially it could infect you, but it's not the same as this illness, where if you're a metre away or something and someone sneezes, it could infect you. So, you know, you have to have different plans in place as to how that infection might manifest in a person and how it might spread between people. This outbreak of coronavirus at the moment has occurred in a country that has the capacity to address it and had preparedness plans in place and, as we see, has enacted them. The problem with the Ebola epidemic was in part that we sat on it for a while and didn't act, and also it involved countries that didn't have the capacity or health infrastructure to address it. And so it was very difficult to identify people quickly. It was difficult to isolate them quickly because there simply weren't the facilities to do it and they needed to be constructed. So I think we're in a very different situation here with the coronavirus simply because of the country in which it's occurred.
Now, John, why do so many of these pandemics seem to originate in Asia?
Probably because there's many more people. I mean, half the population of the world are there.
Well, you've talked about the size of the population, but is it also about what people eat and how they find their food? I mean, bats, for instance, are carriers of some of these diseases, aren't they?
Go to Africa, go to India, you'll find them in the markets. You
know, they taste like chicken?
Yes. I've eaten one with the bats. I mean, once you've cooked them, you're okay. You can keep a family going for a couple of days on a bat. So you can see in Africa, in Kinshasa or wherever, you can send the three-year-old or four-year-old down the bottom of the garden. If they find a dead bat, bring it in, and we'll cook it. But she has or he has handled it. I swear that's a weakness. Between picking it up and carrying it into the kitchen, they've handled it. The bat has been licking itself, cleaning its fur and all this sort of stuff. So the virus will be all over it. And so pretty soon you've got a case of Ebola in the child, and then that child's buried and you get it in the mum.
I just want to imagine now that I'm responsible for the health of the country, I'm health minister, and I'm trying to work out what to do. John Oxford, you advised the government back in 2002 over SARS?
Well, I think it's a bit highfalutin to say advise them. They were in the mode of calling a couple of virologists and see what they've got to tell us.
OK, so the government called you in.
I get a call to come in to Whitehall, and the minister is the really nice man, Johnson.
That'll be Labour's Alan Johnson.
All right, so we sit around the table or something on this. There are three of us. And he said, well, what are we going to do? You know, other countries seem to be stopping aircraft. Could we cut Britain off from the rest of the world? That'll stop it, won't it? And the answer was from the three of us, no, that won't stop it. It's probably already here. And all you're going to do is disrupt the economy, upset everyone and cause mayhem. And his words, I'll always remember, he said, look, you three eggheads, if I can put it that way. He said, you've forgotten one major thing. And we said, hey, what's that? And the major thing was the Daily Mail. And he said, look, what'll happen is I'll go along with your advice. I'm sure it's very scientific. Tomorrow morning, I'll open up the Daily Mail. It'll say, complacent minister. Spain has closed the airspace. France, Canada and England were letting them all in.
Epidemic, what epidemic?
Yes, that'll be the knife in my back.
Josie, this is very much your area, isn't it, really, which is dealing with the risks of action and inaction in the face of what seems to be an epidemic. What should I, as a minister, say about this? I mean, John's just raised the problem that if I don't seem to be alarmed, then in that case I'm complacent. Mm-hmm. If I do seem to be alarmed, I can spread panic.
Evidence base. If you're going to implement any public health interventions, such as closing the airspace, why? Has that shown to actually have an impact? Does it reduce cases? So providing that information and say what you don't know. And I think being honest, keeping it very simple will be important.
And that's pretty much what they've done in China.
In China, they're trying to restrict the movement of people. They are in discussions with the WHO at the moment to understand, you know, how impactful that will be. So we'll have more updates from the WHO later today when the emergency committee meet.
In fact, by the time this programme goes out, you might have had that update. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they didn't do it in time for this discussion.
It's a breathtaking intervention, no doubt about it. I took my breath away when someone phoned me up and told me I couldn't believe it. And then I thought, my God, what an amazing intervention. WHO's flapping around, can't make up their mind. A single country, all right, a very scientific country and a dominating country who's a superpower, makes their own mind up. I mean, it was good enough having their president say, look, I don't want more people to die. I want everyone to have a lovely weekend. And to have him say, look, if you don't do it, all my underlings, if you don't take action, I'll have your guts for garters.
Natalie, how effective are quarantines?
The problem with quarantining is that we're dealing with people. And people do not always behave in a rational manner. So what we're seeing right now in Wuhan is interesting because the population generally seem to be obeying this and seem to be very compliant with it. But if you take a different population who perhaps don't have the same level of understanding, perhaps there's been more misinformation, what you might have on your hands is riots instead. And then you've got a situation where actually you've got much more disease spread because you've got people coming together fighting the authorities. And in that context, quarantining an entire city isn't going to work. In fact, it's probably going to make the situation worse. And I think we saw in West Africa that because there was a lot of misinformation, there was a lot of mistrust of governments. If you tried to quarantine...
And that was Ebola.
Yeah, with Ebola. If you tried to quarantine a community, people fought against it and people were very afraid. And I think one of the things that to some degree was misunderstood with the Ebola epidemic was the level of irrational fear that people can feel when they have potentially been exposed but may not be infected yet, but they are restricted. And people's natural instinct, when they're afraid, their default position is, what's best for me?
I've just realised something, as you've spoken, which as Health Minister I might like to think about. I've always imagined, and we always imagine, this outbreak occurring somewhere else, and it's somewhere else's problem and they're going to have to deal with it. And then you suddenly ask yourself, what happens if the outbreak were to start in a British city? What would I, as Health Minister, do then? Suppose it was Birmingham.
I think the Chinese society is very exceptional. It always has been. Helping the world by having one child. I mean, what a contribution they've made. They really have. And now coming up with this, they can do it. It's one of the few societies probably in the world.
But could we?
No.
Well, so, Jesse, I'm rather scared now because I'm not scared of the Chinese outbreak. But if it happens somewhere else and if it happens here, then maybe we won't be able to adopt the same measures in quite such a disciplined way.
But I think we have to remember what we have in the UK. So we have a very strong health system. We have great hospitals. We have functioning laboratory diagnostic capabilities. We have the ability to diagnose it quickly. We have good ways to communicate with our public. And I think the first step as a health minister would be, you know, self-identify. Are you feeling unwell? Do you need to go to the doctors? Do you need to go to the hospital? If you can stay at home, you know, that's a form of quarantine yourself, trying not to overload our health systems already. So I would put those kind of communication measures to the public and have that discussion with them rather than making a blanket, we should close off Birmingham. This won't work.
Now, going back to the current crisis and still being the health minister, what I might be worried about is if people do get alarmed, if they all go to their doctors and they all go to hospital, then that's a whole lot of other treatments aren't going to happen.
And we are at the moment in the flu season, so we already have a lot more increase of people going to hospitals, not feeling very well and being treated there. This is part of the challenge, I think, for all countries will be, how will it impact your health system? Will it overwhelm it? Which is probably what's occurring now in Wuhan. This is a big risk, and this is something you as health minister would have to prepare for.
How should I do it?
Well, think about being overwhelmed. It's usually down to the workforce. Are they the ones who are going to become ill? So what's your backup plan for that, to have people come in and take their place?
What is my backup plan for that?
I don't know.
Yes, it's not one I care to give in Parliament. Now, the World Health Organization, as we know, is about to, just has made an announcement of whether this is a global emergency. What difference does calling a global emergency actually make in practical terms, Jacey?
The key difference really is the political will. It's telling other countries around the world that you need to do something, you need to step up and you need to make sure that you're prepared. Calling a public health emergency of international concern is around having a global international collaborative response effort. So countries need to share the information as it's coming out. If there's new information on treatment options, sharing that. If there's new information on how the virus is behaving, particularly, is it changing? Is it transmitting differently? Is the severity of the disease differently? So it's being more cooperative. That's the major one. It's putting investment behind it as well. You know, we need to make sure we have those plans in place for the just in case. And potentially, you know, provide support to other countries as well.
OK, a final question to all three of you. With what degree of trepidation right now, for either yourselves or for your elderly relatives or for your children, do you treat the current moment? John?
I'm not worried at all. I really am not. Just very small numbers we're dealing with here. I mean, I will be more worried about measles, children not being vaccinated against measles, and polio coming back again, things like that, common or garden things, much more worried than I am about Wuhan virus.
Jesse.
I would say I'm quite, you know, worried about the influenza season as it is now and just making sure that my elderly relatives are looked after. I think as it coming to the, you know, to the UK, it may come, but I think we are in a good position at the moment.
Natalie.
I think in terms of my relatives, I'm not particularly concerned. I will provide them with the necessary advice in terms of hand washing and so on, and maybe some precautions if they plan to transit through airports and high population density areas. But I think that my concern comes down to more the overwhelming of health systems if it were to spread and the subsequent impact on other conditions, rather than necessarily the fatality rates from this virus and the level of disease it causes. I'd be more concerned that we won't be treating other things because our health system could be overwhelmed.
That was Dr. Natalie McDermott with Professor John Oxford and Dr. Josie Golding. And the conclusion from this is obviously, don't panic, there's no need, this isn't the big one. If there is a threat, it's probably to additional demand on health services, creating problems elsewhere. But always remember, out there in the microscopic world, encouraged by some human practices, tiny organisms are silently evolving. My thanks to Howard Zhang, Dr. Natalie McDermott, Professor John Oxford and Dr. Josie Golding. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Rosamund Jones. The editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might find other episodes interesting, including ones on the Revolutionary Guard of Iran, the environmental cost of meat eating, bats not included, and what getting Brexit done actually means. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Ida, schau an, ich hab da was gefunden.
Zum Kinostart von Pumuckl und das große Missverständnis waren Pumuckl und Meister Eder bei Dens Biomarkt unterwegs.
Der wird schauen, der Eder.
Entdecke tolle Aktionen zum Kinofilm und leckere Produkte jetzt exklusiv in deinem Dens Biomarkt.
Wie ich das wieder hinbekommen hab.
Ja, Wahnsinn.
Alle Lieblingsspeisen zum Film gibt's jetzt in deinem Dens Biomarkt und Pumuckls neues Leinwandabenteuer Pumuckl und das große Missverständnis startet ab 30. Oktober exklusiv im Kino.
Hallo. It's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.